Welcome to Mustard A&A's. I am Matt.
I'm Richard.
And we discuss things in the entertainment industry that we find interesting. Mm-hmm. Movies, TV, DVDs, video games, a little bit of tech.
Yep.
And there we are.
Yep.
Are you trying to say something?
Nope. I was just saying yep.
Oh, okay. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, last show we had a lot of movies to talk about and catch up on, and this show I, of course, have seen no movies.
Yeah, I haven't either. I mean, I haven't seen any movies in the theater.
I don't even think I've seen any on DVD or on my DVR. Hmm. Sounds like you, for some reason, saw like five last night.
I don't know what was going on, but last night I just decided to sit down and watch movies on my little big screen, and let me just think, because I saw so damn many movies. I started out watching, My Best Fiend, which is a, by the way, these are all movies I've seen before. It wasn't like I was watching something new. So it's a documentary by Werner Herzog about Klaus Kinski, which is a great movie. Then I saw another documentary about Leni Riefenstahl, the famous Nazi director, called The Wonderful Horrible Life of Leni Riefenstahl. Then, what the heck else? I saw, something else, and then I watched L.A. Confidential. I don't know what, I had this bug up my butt to watch L.A. Confidential again. So then I watched that. Uh-huh. Then I still wasn't all that tired. So then I decided to watch Sorcerer, which is the William Friedkin movie from like the mid-70s, which is like my favorite movie of all time.
That one. That's the one with
Roy Scheider. And he plays a guy that's down on his luck that's in South America and has to, and him and some others decide to agree to take nitroglycerin, this unstable nitroglycerin, across this mountain pass to put out an oil fire or an oil well fire. It's actually, I love that movie totally. And I
have watched your copy and I found it bizarre.
Really? I love that movie.
Well, not bizarre in the sense that, you know, there were aliens tap dancing in it or something. Aliens tap dancing? Well, that would be bizarre.
Well, there's no aliens tap dancing.
I'm saying that I have overstated my case and calling it bizarre, but I watched it and I turned it off and I was like, okay, I'm not really sure what that was.
There's elements to it that are dated in a sense that it was like the first movie that Tangerine Dream did the score for, and you forget how much of a cliche Tangerine Dream became from the, you know, the late 70s through the mid 80s, because they ended up doing the scores for a bunch of movies like Michael Mann's Thief and Risky Business, and it just screams that time frame. And this was the first one that did it, this kind of electronic thing. And then there's a couple other elements that are really kind of dated, but some of the scenes in there, like this scene of them taking these trucks across this flooded river on this crazy bridge. I mean, they're just incredible. But anyway, so and then after that, I still wasn't tired, and I was watching Slingbox, and I just happened to, there's this dumb movie called The Jacket that was on, starring Adrian Brody and Keira Knightley, and I missed the first like third of it, and I find myself watching that thing. So in succession, I sat down and watched like six movies in a row. I don't think I've ever done
that. Well, for a second, I thought you said The Tuxedo with Jackie Chan.
No, that's a
Jennifer Love Hewitt.
This wasn't a great movie, but that movie I had the distinct displeasure of actually seeing in the theaters. My brother was like for my niece's birthday like 3 or 4 years ago, and they thought, well, let's go see a movie. I thought, well, I don't know, this might be fun. And I actually saw The Tuxedo in the movie theaters. Holy Christ. I can think of all the great movies that I didn't bother to see in the theater, but that movie I did, and I can never get that day back.
I agree.
So it was funny watching the L.A. Confidential and seeing the making. It's one of those DVDs they put out when they were first putting out DVDs. It was like 1998. So they have a bunch of, like, the extras on the disc are not that great. a lot of slideshows, you know, press next and read something. You never see them, or you never see a slideshow of like, read this, and that has like a, like you're actually reading information. They just don't do that anymore. And, right. And then they had little, in the making of thing, they had little interviews with, you know, Russell Crowe, who nobody ever seen before. And he's so excited and genial, and Guy Pearce, they're genial. It's like, wow. I mean, it's just weird to see him when nobody had seen him before. And you could see the little, what do they call it? The test reels they did for them, audition reels. And man, they were good. You can see exactly why they got hired for that movie. It was kind of cool. I hadn't seen it in a long time, and it's pretty much as great as it ever was. You're watching it and going, okay, I love this movie. Not totally sure why everybody fawned over Kim Basinger. She was great, but everybody was great. I don't know why necessarily she won the Oscar and nobody else didn't. But great movie. You what?
Yeah, and God, the only I was trying to think of movie news to talk about, but all I could think of is Cloverfield is next week.
Yeah, I read an article about that yesterday that it kind of surprised me, although it doesn't surprise me, but in a sense, but I'd never seen an article about it where it essentially was a challenge that J.J. Abrams did to himself, where he said, well, damn, let's make a low budget movie. Let's give ourselves a $25 million budget, and the vast majority of that budget we're going to spend on effects. So let's literally film a bunch of this with like a little handheld cheap camera, with no stars, and then throw most of our money into effects. And the whole movie apparently costs like $25 million. The advertising clearly costs even more than the movie, but I kind of didn't realize that that's the way it was going.
And there's a couple, I think Jeffrey Wells said, it's like 74 minutes long.
Yeah, so it's...
I find that astounding.
Yeah.
And a little... I mean, and he says it works within the concept of the movie, which is fine, but, I mean, that's an hour and 14 minutes.
Yeah, every once in a while a movie will be really short like that, and you'll just be surprised in this day
and
age.
Well, usually they're comedies.
Yeah.
And to me, it's like, well, you don't want to dictate how the filmmaker should make a movie, but on the other hand, if I'm going to go in and spend money on something... I have to admit, I have a certain expectation that it's going to be at least an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And, you know, 2 hours is sort of the accepted norm. You know, that's what I get for my money. And when I get 74 minutes, I start to question that.
Yeah.
You know, and that doesn't mean it's... I don't want
to... Yeah, I start to think of, what was that horrible...
Pee on it, but there's a value thing that starts to come into the equation, like, geez, I'm sure it's great, but it takes a certain amount of effort and money to truck out to the theater and... I'd like a little more entertainment.
You remember when Dana Carvey had that horrible, horrible movie, Master of Disguise?
Where yes.
Him, and that movie, which I, oh, God. I the only reason I even have seen it in one form or another is because my niece just thought it was hilarious, and my brother would basically have an endless loop at his house. And watching that thing probably clocked in at 60 minutes. And it was so bad that they literally, what they did is they kind of, to stretch it out, the credits, they literally had like Dana Carvey basically improv over the credits. So the credits are like 12 minutes long in this movie. The 60 minute movie has a credit sequence that's like 15 minutes long.
That's insane.
And it was horrible and painful to watch. And I remember watching it thinking, wow, how could they not just have come up with something else to stretch this movie out longer than 60 minutes, but somehow they couldn't do it. But in another respect, the movie was so bad that you're kind of grateful that it was that short. And I don't suspect Cloverfield's in the same category. I suspect that it's just, wow, is it really that short? Really? They couldn't, well, you know? I mean, maybe they sell the story, but it just seems kind of weird. You're in the theater and then you're out. I'm sure the theater owners are happy. They'll be able to get one extra showing and make that much more money.
There's a couple other things about it that sort of popped up over the week. There's an image of the monster or a couple going around.
Yeah.
And I actually didn't really study the story because the image was right there and I didn't want to look at it. So I don't know if it was a purported image or the actual thing.
Well, I looked at some and they were claiming a site that I saw had images, but they're very clear saying, this is an image, this is the it was described in detail by some source, so these are a bunch of people that have submitted their suggestions of what it would look like based on the detailed description, and they were actually kind of close to each other, which was interesting. So,
okay,
but I don't know what that means.
I am trying to avoid learning what the thing looks like. So.
Yeah.
And the other thing that was interesting, and again, this is Jeffrey Wells. He brought up, and I think it was him, and I don't know if he was just regurgitating some other article about how the phenomena of a big name producer overshadowing the director on a project.
Yeah.
Like, you know, everyone thinks of J.J. Abrams, you know, being, they probably all think that he directed Cloverfield, but he didn't. He was the producer. It was another director whose name I don't remember.
I was actually kind of thinking of doing a post on that, and then I noticed some other site totally beat me to it, of big movies where the person you think or assume is the director is not the director, and it sort of happened this past year with Superbad, Greg Mottola.
Yeah, that's the other big example.
And then there's other famous ones like Poltergeist. Everybody seemed to remember, of course, Steven Spielberg directed Poltergeist, when, of course, he didn't. Tobe Hooper directed Poltergeist. And recently, and we had mentioned this, I think, on a previous podcast, was George Hickenlooper directed this awesome documentary called Hearts of Darkness about the making of Apocalypse Now, but everybody assumes it was actually directed by Eleanor Coppola because she narrates it and it used footage that she did, and they just released a DVD of it, and damn it, even Francis Ford Coppola is kind of implying that she directed it and sort of relegated Hickenlooper and his partner off to the side, which kind of sucked.
So I was going to ask you if you finally got that.
No, I'm sort of broke. I've got a list of about 6 DVDs. Like,
boy, and that's you've been talking about that thing forever.
I don't need money. I need to get a job. I have $3.09 in my account right now. So until I get a job, I'll kind of put it on hold. There's that. There's the Blade Runner DVD that I want to get.
Oh yeah, but that how much is that thing?
It's actually, if you're not getting the one with the ridiculous crap, you can get the version with all 5 discs and everything for like $25. So it's not bad. And I just haven't gotten it. And there's a couple others out there. But I sort of need to have actual money to get them. I'm really totally tapped out.
There's this new Blade Runner release, which has like 5 discs, and it comes in a briefcase, basically.
Yeah, which, where am I going to put that thing? So,
well,
screw
that's
it.
The other thing. It's like, on one hand, that's kind of cool. On the other hand, where do you put that? That is ridiculous. It doesn't go at all in a DVD rack.
I have a couple specialty cases, and uniformly, they all suck. The first one is the Total Recall one, which is in a round tin, which, if you put it in any shelf, it's going to roll off of it. Fortunately, I managed to save the little cardboard thing that holds it in, and it hasn't fallen apart yet. Then there's the horrible nightmare of the Simpsons cases, which are all shaped like they're plastic things shaped like the heads of the Simpsons, which are awful.
I've got one or two of those, but they fit in the rack.
They do, but they're awful for a variety of reasons. But you're right, at least they fit in the rack. Then I've got one or two case things where they make these bigger cases of them, and it screws everything up. One is for this 2-lane blacktop, which apparently they re-released on DVD. Like it's funny, every once in a while they'll put a movie out on DVD again, and then all the critics and stuff won't seem to acknowledge that it was released in a special edition previous to this. They'll sort of forget. And 2-Lane Blacktop was put out in a special tin, and I happened to see it cheap, used, so I got the tin, and of course it sits there like a lump in my collection, enormously taking up all this room sideways on top of others. I hate them. I just hate them. Do a special edition, everything, but make sure ultimately it has the same exact form factor as any other DVD. I don't want anything different. I don't want anything special.
I've got a friend at work who's a Blade Runner fan, and because he's got 2 young girls, he hasn't done actual gift exchange with his wife yet.
Yep.
And B, he said, like, all of his stuff from before he was married is, like, in a storage unit so his two little girls don't destroy it.
Yeah.
Or, in his words, put cute puffy stickers on everything.
Yeah.
And so I was asking him last week, oh, did you get the Blade Runner thing yet? He's like, no, we haven't done it yet. Hmm. And I said, that'd be pretty funny if you got that and then you, like, put it up in the top shelf of your closet so your girls don't find it. It's like, no, no, that's not a gun case or porn or anything. It's your Blade Runner briefcase. Anyway, and something I had meant to actually do a post on, and then just didn't.
What's up?
Was that David Pogue article yep. about the National Treasure movie trailer?
Yeah,
and how he went to see it with his family, and almost none of the scenes in the trailer happened, or the few that were in the movie were taken completely out of context.
Did you see the John Turtelob post about it afterwards where he responded?
I did not.
He's the director.
Yes, I know that.
And he said he kind of cringed when he sort of saw that trailer too, because it was, you know, and he brings up a very good point, which is basically the way movies work nowadays. Used to be they'd film a movie, then they'd spend. They literally film a movie without any confirmed when it's going to be a release date and everything else.
Right.
Now they're literally filming movies like the new James Bond movie is being filmed as we speak, and it's going to be released at the end of this year. And so it's done in succession. And when they put together the first ad, the Book of Secrets wasn't even half finished. So they right. sent them stuff. For stuff they hope to be in the movie, and he was saying, well, there's a couple things. One is things that work really well in a trailer work terrible in a movie, like lines of dialogue that work really well in a trailer, like quick, you know, that might describe some of the action. When you throw it into a movie, it just sticks out like a sore thumb. And then other times you'll be filming scenes which will seem great, but then later you pull out. And he was talking specifically about scenes filmed at the Mount Rushmore and this thing. And honestly, I saw the scenes too, and I thought, oh, cool, they're gonna be doing something in some secret room behind Mount Rushmore, which they didn't do. And you know, so
did you see the movie, dude? Oh boy. Richard?
So anyway, the movie was, so apparently the director was himself kind of embarrassed by that, but he was trying to explain how it happened. And I'm ambivalent about it, because I think in some cases it's absolutely correct. In other cases, I like it when they'll film some funny stuff that's specifically for the trailer. And I can understand it, but in this case, it seemed to be way over the top when they have a trailer that really, truly is almost unrelated to the movie, and that just seems like false advertising. Even if they explain why, they need to be at least a little more cognizant of that. It just seems kind of unfair, because they may have cut that trailer halfway through the movie, but they were showing that trailer right up until the day the movie got released.
And so, you've implied it, but you haven't strictly said, you know, the trailer is cut together by the marketing department
yeah.
and is not at all related to the people actually creating the movie.
Yeah.
You know, they send in dailies and, you know, finished or not finished, they send in footage to the movie company, and after that, they have no idea what the trailer is going to look like.
Yeah.
But the interesting point that Pogue raises that I haven't seen addressed anywhere before is, at what point does it become false advertising?
Yeah.
And, you know, him saying, you know what? A lot of my wanting to go to this movie was based on what I saw in the trailer and an expectation that I would see these scenes and situations. And when I don't see these situations, I've been sold a false bill of goods.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, he's got something there. That's really interesting. And I honestly don't see why you couldn't actually take that further if you want. I mean, it's kind of a jerk thing to do and maybe a nuisance lawsuit. But if you start thinking about it seriously, you know, if you take it seriously, maybe it forces the studios to readdress some of their marketing practices, which I'm sure will never happen. But
Yeah.
I don't know.
But like, to Turtelob's credit, though, I think the biggest problem here is they put the trailer together so early in the process that it absolutely represented what this movie will probably look like in some way, shape, or form at the time they put together. And as they finished the film, that whole thing changed. And the problem there is they didn't cut a new trailer. They just kept showing the old one I don't know. I tend to agree with them, but on another level, it's like, oh, it's National Treasure, Book of Secrets. Well, I have zero interest in seeing this movie. So, but I don't know.
Yeah. That's the other unspoken thing is, come on, it's a piece of garbage.
And how did this movie make so damn much money? It was like number one movie for 3 weeks in a row, for God's sake.
It's the lowest common denominator, and if you look at it, there really isn't anything else with broad appeal.
Yeah.
I mean, we can say There Will Be Blood came out, but it's totally different audiences.
Well, Juno came out, and it's killing, and it's finally pulled ahead of them this week alone. Let me see if the weekend is up yet. No, yeah, weekend's not up yet, but Juno's like kicking butt.
Haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it either. I had that opportunity to see the sneak preview, and then I just sort of bailed on it. But
you sent me an email, and you're like, dude, I've got things to see this, and it's Thursday. And I'm like, dude, yeah. A, I've never heard of this movie, and B, I'm going to have to work.
I didn't know you hadn't heard of it. I knew this was going to be the big thing. But anyway, I just didn't bother. But it's already, I mean, depending on how I did this weekend, it's already up about $75 million, which is incredible considering it's a tiny little independent movie. Yeah. But then, sadly, the Chipmunks movie's probably made $500 million worldwide at this point.
Oh, my God.
I know. What's the world coming to? Anyway.
So we're just going to sort of randomly bop around as we continue here. Apparently, you have finished Halo 3 on Heroic.
You know, it's funny. We have a couple Halo posts, so they have those ridiculous contextual ads for Google. And right now, at least the one I'm looking at, the little square ad is for Get Halo, the world's only germ-killing vacuum. So apparently somebody's come up with a vacuum cleaner called the Halo. And I'm thinking, how could these people not have recognized that when they're buying these ads through Google that it's going to show up on a bunch of fanboy video game sites?
Is pretty funny.
And I put up that other one, too, where I put up a link to every time I go to the same John Dvorak page, it's this page where he wrote it like 3 years ago, and he's just ranting about Alaska Airlines and how poor the quality service is. And every time you go to that thing, the banner ad at the top of it, the Google banner ad, is for a Fly Alaska Airlines ad. I mean, it could not be a less effective place to place one of those ads. But because so much of it says Alaska Airlines, it always is Alaska Airlines ad. But anyway, so Halo 3, I sat down and decided to play it at Heroic, not Legendary, which I don't think I'm ever capable of, although I actually haven't tried it, but Heroic. And I finished it probably, I don't know, maybe 5 or 10 hours. So I'm glad I did it. It was kind of funny. I still think that the first big level is actually, it was really hard when I played it the first time, and it was kind of hard even the second time I played it. But other parts, you end up realizing pretty quickly, I'm just going to sit here and play it. But at some point, you start to remember, you know what, I can just run by everything here, and if I'm lucky, I won't get killed, and I'll just bypass this. So there's a couple levels where you just sort of run, which you didn't realize at the beginning, but you can just sort of bypass them.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, so, and then once again, I realized, I started to play it, and I started to have this sense memory, isn't there this level coming up that I hate? That is hard, and you can't figure out where the hell you are. And then I kept thinking, "Oh my God, was that on Orange Box? Was that on?" And then I got to level and go, "Oh no, it was Halo 3. I forgot how much I hated that. It wasn't quite as bad this time around, but it still was bad. It was that whole Cortana level that makes you feel like you're in the colon of something with all, and you can't figure out where the hell you are." And
I hate that whole biological look.
I hate it, too.
Not only that game, but any time there's a game that does something like that, I hate it.
Yeah, they did that for a bit in the the orange box, the latest level of Half-Life, and I hate it there too. And it was, you know, the other thing I always hate about Halo is for whatever reason they design these levels, and I'd swear 50 to 70% of the levels you play through it, and then your next step is to run backwards through the whole level, avoiding, you know, wave after wave of things. And I hate that of, you know, you've played a level and then you're going through it again only in reverse some way. It just always strikes me as the height of lazy programming, you know. But anyway, I enjoyed it quite a bit. I was proud of myself. I did it with Ghost Recon Advanced Warfighter 2, and I've now done this mostly because I couldn't afford it, where I've played it through at a tougher level, and it was fun. You know?
Yeah, I still need to borrow that from you.
What's that? Oh, the Gras 2?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. It's way better than the first one. The first one wasn't bad.
Yeah, and I offered to lend you Mass Effect.
Yeah, I don't know. Just not totally. It's not my kind of game that much.
Yes, but you understand I would be loaning it to you for
No,
free.
I understand, but even loaning it, I sort of, I don't know, the idea of even starting a game and not finishing it is hard for me to contemplate because I am an achievement whore. So I'm more inclined to just not do it. I have a feeling if I get any money, the next game I'll get will probably be Assassin's Creed. And then after that, I don't know. Definitely when Grand Theft Auto comes out, I'll get that. But I don't care.
When is that? What's the release date for that now? March? February?
Yeah, something like that. Kind of sucks. I remember when I got my Xbox, it sounds goofy, but I got it partially because they have decided to put a firm date on when they were releasing it, which was going to be November 4th, 2007. And I bought my Xbox on November 4th, 2006, going, man, I've got 1 year. You know, I remember thinking, 1 year before this thing came out, and then they pushed it. And they don't have a firm date. They just said it would be... I think they said it would be Q2 2007, or 2008, which might mean as late as June 30th.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it sucks.
I actually finished Assassin's Creed myself.
Yeah? So what did you think?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was interesting that there's sort of this framing device that you're interacting with as well.
The DNA thing?
Yeah, I guess we talked about it last time.
Yep.
And before, you know, in between, you know, your regression sessions when you're doing the period piece of being an assassin, you're this dude in a hoodie walking around sort of this lab environment. And apparently there's this part in one of the middle walking around sessions when you're supposed to do something, and I totally didn't do it. I had no concept I was supposed to do it. And it turns out later that because of that, I missed some information which would really help fill in the backstory, but actually wasn't, you know, I realized if you completely missed this aspect of the game, you wouldn't know that you missed it. And I thought, that's really interesting, where you would think that you've done a great job, but really you hadn't.
Yeah,
some games you realize you finish it and you're like, wait a minute, I missed something. Something doesn't make sense and I'm missing it and I don't get this. But in this case, that didn't happen at all. I thought I was just fine and I go poking around on the internet to look something up and all of a sudden I realize, well, wait a minute, I didn't do that. When was that supposed to happen?
The game producers, you think, boy, they're trying something different. They're saying, well, let's have an experience where if they miss something, they can get by fine, but if they don't, you know, whatever. I personally, it kills me, the thought that I missed something. Whether it prevents me from an achievement or it's just an aspect of the game that I missed and I can't easily go back and get to that. I hate that. It kills me.
I still hate it, but I don't let it get me anymore. And I thought, well, maybe I should take a save and... And I was like, you know what? No, forget it. I don't care. It's already gone.
Yeah.
I just...
Yeah.
It's such a tremendous time sink. And at the end of the day, I have to tell myself, it's just a video game.
No, I understand, too. It just makes me mad that I've made that choice. I've decided not to. With Halo 3, I started my... play with the anticipation, okay, I'm going to go get all those skulls.
Right.
And I got the first one, and I had gotten some more before, but I got the first one. And then I kind of forgot about it. As I was playing through, I just started just, I was concentrating, just flying through this thing. And then I realized, oh, crap, I forgot, like, all of the skulls. And I ain't ever going to do it. But I really would have had I thought about it. So it kind of, I don't know, I felt, I, it just kind of sucked.
But, anyway. you did a thing on P.T. Anderson saying he now wishes he could reduce Magnolia by about 20 minutes.
Oh, I thought that was interesting. I saw there was a CNN article, and they were interviewing him, and he pointedly said, yeah, I think it was something, he said something taught him recently about this whole idea of cutting and the importance and how you can love that. Because, you know, otherwise these long movies seem overly indulgent. And the funny thing about Magnolia was the original cut of that movie was like 4 hours and something. And there's some famous noted actors who their entire roles in that movie was cut out. I'm trying to remember who, but there was some African-American actor who was like still kind of ticked that they spent all this time filming this movie and they're not even in it. And he's saying, yeah, but dude, the movie was like 4.5 hours. So at its current length, it was still much shorter than what it was, but he says, yeah, looking at it now, I could just easily lop off 20 minutes. I thought that was interesting. It shows you how he's progressed and how he starts to realize the importance of storytelling rather than the importance of just throwing more stuff in there that adds richness to the movie but detracts from it in another sense. I thought that was interesting.
I thought it was interesting, too, and I've kind of been thinking about that one recently as well. Is, you know, There Will Be Blood made me think about his previous films and kind of wanting to see Boogie Nights again because I haven't seen that in a while.
Yeah.
And
I thought about watching that again, too, last night, but I was going down my list and Sorcerer came up first. did you see my recollection? I don't know if it's correct, but I remember you and I saw that sneak preview of Magnolia, and my recollection is that it was supposed to start like at 10:20, and it was like late. And then we had that fire alarm, and I seem to remember getting out of that theater like at 3 a.m. or something. I just remember it being nightmares, I'm surprised at this point that I actually didn't fall asleep, because nowadays anything that late, I'm going to fall asleep right through, but somehow I didn't. It kept my interest, but I just remember it being a really long movie that started late and was interrupted by a half-hour fire alarm.
No, I mean, it's, you may be remembering it incorrectly, but that sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah.
For some reason, the fire alarm experience I remember is back in November or December of 1990, 91?
Yeah.
Whenever Star Trek VI was coming out, and that was when I was actually working at a theater. And the way, I assume this still works the same, but when movie theaters receive prints, you know, they come, well, I know this part still works the same, when they actually receive a print versus a digital satellite thing now, in some of them, it comes in 20-minute reels, and a guy has to splice them all together, and then the whole thing goes on a big horizontal platter. Now, there are some old-school theaters that actually will play the reels, and you have a projectionist that starts one projector as the other one is finishing, and that's old school. So now they said they splice the whole thing together, put it on this big platter. And the way my theater did it was they had a special guy that would come in and do it. It wasn't like the assistant manager was doing it. And I think he worked for the theater chain, but that was like his main job, was to go around and assemble these things for the various theaters in the area. And then what's supposed to happen is an assistant manager is supposed to watch it like Thursday, you know, whenever it's assembled, but before it gets shown to the public, to make sure that it's put together in the correct order and that the sound is working and all of that. You know, and so this happens at like 2 a.m. on a Thursday night on the Friday before it goes live. And usually it's just supposed to be the assistant manager. You kind of bend the rules, and, you know, with Star Trek, and I was, and to a lesser degree still am, a huge Trekkie. So I'm like, dude, what do I need to do to get in to see Star Trek VI with you before anyone else? You know, and they were cool about it. And there were actually some other employees from one of the other theaters that wasn't getting the film that came over to do it. And we start watching it at, I don't know, midnight or something. And it was, and this was in the Bay Area. And I don't know, like 40 minutes in, the fire alarm goes off. So exact same thing, you know, 30 minutes waiting in the lobby while the fire department came. And it had been the first bit of cold in the area for the winter, so the heating system hadn't come on, so the heating vents were all dusty, so the dust in the heating vents had smoked when the heat came on.
Oh, man.
So I remember that's my fire alarm.
I think I told you this once, but I had a similar experience when we went to see The Hunt for Red October. And we sit down in the theaters, we sit through a bunch of previews for upcoming movies. Then it gets dark. The movie's about to start, and it's dark, and it's like really dark. And we're sitting there, and after about 5 minutes, we realize nothing's coming up. It's as dark as it's ever been in a theater. There's no lights on, and then a few brave, hardy souls walk out in the outside and realize all the theater's off. And finally, after 10 minutes, it's pitch black. Somebody comes up and says, "There's been a power outage in the whole neighborhood grid, and we're gonna sit here tight and see what happens." And after 10 more minutes, they say, "Well, we're gonna cancel this." So, and they didn't plan it out. They sort of implied, well, you can get a refund at the box office or some kind of stamp to get or get another movie or something. What they really should have just said is, hang on to your ticket stubs and you can present it for any movie in the next week or something. But what they did, but they didn't do that. So consequently, it was in that Alderwood theater, the one that's not the new one, but not the old Grand Cinema Alderwood. So everybody piled out of their theaters and then just packed into this main artery of a hall in the theaters and waited in line to get their refunds or whatever. And it was freaky and kind of scary because it was like pitch black and it was freezing cold because the theaters were, you know, it wasn't heated and the power was out and stuff. And there's all these people waiting in line when in reality they shouldn't have done that. So it's just freaky. And finally,
that's standard. I mean, that was the policy when I was working there because of the way where it was located, it was susceptible. It was some power pole that cars kept hitting that side of the portion of the city on the other side of the freeway would constantly have power outages.
No, I understand. I'm just saying from a just the theater owner's perspective, I had wished they had come up with a better way than doing it because you could see like a mass crowd dynamics going into effect there as people were getting anxious, people were getting like paranoid, people were getting unruly, and you could see something bad happening if the wrong thing had happened because you had an enormous number of people packed into a very tight spot. The lights were totally off, so you're there packed in. You couldn't hardly see anything, and you're there with like 2,000 other people all squeezed together or more. And really, I think the theater owner's main job at that point was getting people out of the theater. And they could have just as easily done what they actually eventually did do, which is to say, just hang on to your ticket, we'll honor it. But they didn't do that, so you had all these people sitting there waiting, freaking out. And to my dad's credit, he said, let's just go. And we snuck out a side door, fortunately.
Well, yeah, it's,
I don't think it was going to be some British soccer riot disaster that was going to happen, but I could see something going wrong and somebody freaking out. Knowing myself how claustrophobic I get, I could imagine a group of 100 people in this crowd of 2,000 just like me kind of ruining it for everybody because they're freaking out, you know. But anyway.
And I think really the last thing on my list to talk about would be writer strike stuff.
Yep. I don't know what to make of it, man. Did you see at various times I think the writers are totally screwing it up and then others say no they're doing this right and they're picking their battles and they're cutting these little side deals with very specific people like Weinstein and I don't know. It's hard to know what the hell's going on.
I think they're doing it right, but I have to say a lot of my, you know, a lot of how I think about this is shaped by the Mark Evanier website because he's a writer. And, you know, I've been reading this guy for years. And on his blog, he does pretty regular strike updates. And, you know, he says, you know what? The mood of the writers is solid. The previous, you know, the last time there was a strike, it was much more, you know, having a camp inside saying, let's settle, let's settle, let's settle. And this time they're much more united. And he's saying, you know, like he had a post up the other day about how, like, I guess Bill Maher's show is back, and Bill Maher just
it was painful. Hey, you know what, dude? I'm going to hang up and call you right back. Stay recording, because I can't even understand what you're saying. So stay recording. I'm going to call you right back. Hang on just a second here. And...
Yes.
Okay, much better. I'm about to give up on this freaking Skype. But anyway, yeah, Bill Maher's thing, I was like, oh, my God, thank God I had set up for TiVo for it to come on, because I love that show. And he did a remarkably good job considering he had no writers. And he started out by saying very heartfelt how much of a union guy he is, how much he wants his writers back, how much he loves them, and we need more unions and yada, yada, yada. And they said, but there's this thing in Hollywood where you can't say anything bad and yada, yada, and the writers are screwing this thing up, and then they're putting all kinds of crazy pressure. And it was a weird set of comments, but he was no fan, that's for sure.
Well, Evanier said, you know, I watched the show and I honestly have no idea what he's talking about. He's referring to all of these things that supposedly have happened or have been said that I haven't heard about. And he's like, you know what? I'm walking the picket lines. I'm talking to writers. I'm going to the meetings. I don't know what he's talking about. You know, he's not saying that, you know, Bill Maher's just making it up. He's just saying, he's talking about things that I haven't seen and I've been around. Yeah. So when I say that, you know, from my perspective, it seems like the writers are still going strong. I'm getting it from this one, you know, admittedly pretty biased source, but because I trust him and he's saying, look, here's what it looks like. Here's what's good. Here's what's bad. I think these side deals are good, but I'm not positive. And also, you know, today he had a post up on the Directors Guild, which, you know, they, I guess, yesterday sat down with the producers, the AMPTP, to sort of work out the framework. And, you know, he laid out, here are the four scenarios that I basically see, and one of them's, you know, very unlikely. You know, the Directors Guild has always sort of put itself as sort of the being more in tune with management and not striking, and what happens if they actually, you know, the worst thing that would happen is if they, wait, no. One of the, it would be very bad if they accepted the deal without the new media stuff.
Yeah.
But that's not likely. Anyway, I don't want to just read the guy's post, but it was really interesting. And it will be an interesting dynamic because either side will be able to point to the DGA and say, look, either A, you know, they're standing with us and saying you need to give the same deal for internet that you are for regular stuff. Or B, if they go the other way, they can say, look, writers, you're being totally unreasonable. The directors are on our side. They've already signed the deal. Look how unreasonable you're being.
Yeah.
But that, to me, that seems unlikely because they're not being unreasonable.
Well, I'll tell you the one bit of news that I heard this last week was the, you know, the concept of, I don't know how they pronounce it, force majeure, you know, that concept, which is you sign these contracts, but there's circumstances in a contract that allows you to opt out of them because events take place that totally prevent you from fulfilling that contract. And that kicked in with, I think it was ABC or one of the movie studios where they literally canceled because of force majeure dozens of deals and development deals and other stuff they had with tons of producers and actors and other stuff kicking in where they may have said, okay, we're going to pay you $500,000 to develop this property and yada, yada. And they just were able to wipe the slate clean. And I'm thinking that's when that stuff starts kicking in, that means that those studios have finally said, well, this was painful and we didn't want to get to this point. But once we did, now it's actually easy for us to just continue this because we've wiped those slates clean and we're sitting on piles of cash and we're not making as much as we wanted to, but we don't have to honor those other contracts anymore. I don't know. It just seems to me that I know nothing about it, but it seems to me that the producers, to a lot of extent, are in the driver's seat, especially like right now, because all these shows that they've had sitting in the can for this, you know, for the mid season are actually starting to come on now. So it's not really hitting the audiences that much. They have that Sarah Connors thing, the Wire, the Shield. All these things are coming on right now, and they've got their full seasons in the can. So it's almost like it's not. I don't know. It just seems to me that I think a lot of times writers are, because they're writers and they're hopeful and they can convince themselves that it's going better than it is. My sense isn't that it's going all that great, but I may be wrong, you know.
Well, yeah, but I mean, what else are you gonna? What should they have done?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know. I don't. I mean, it seems so crazily unreasonable where the producers are coming from, you know.
Yeah, and I totally agree. And it's like, you know what? I think it sucks, but I don't think they had any choice.
They're such liars. I mean, I can't help but think all of the ways that I typically these days watch TV are ways that in the past used to ensure that writers got paid, and now the way I do it, writers aren't getting paid. I watched the entire season of The Office on NBC.com, and right now that is considered promotional, so the writers don't get paid for it. I'm watching the whole shows, but the NBC and all the other studios are saying, oh, writers don't need to get paid for that, that's promotion. And it kind of sickens me, and it's so obvious that the companies are being disingenuous, but you know, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, it will be interesting to see what happens if it drags on. And, you know, if the writers, you know, clearly what the Directors Guild does and then the Screen Actors Guild does will really, I think, dictate sort of what's going to happen. But, you know, if, you know, and we've hit this point over and over and over again, but there's a point where you have to say, look, we don't want to, at one point the strike will be over, in theory, and we'll need to work with these people again. But you have to wonder if there's a point where they say, look, you know what? We'll just use the internet for distribution method ourselves, and we'll start making shows without the studios. We'll do some sort of small thing that's smart and agile and can still get content out there on the internet, and clearly the audience will be vastly smaller. But maybe we're willing to put the time and investment in to build it up and do something new and say, you know what? These studios are screwing us so bad.
Yeah.
Let's you know what? Let's rip the Band-Aid off. Let's try a new method of getting our stuff out there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's such a tremendous sea change, and I understand it's got to be tremendously scary to even contemplate, but I know it's being thought of. When I was at San Diego in the summer and I went to see Joss Whedon speak, he was bringing that sort of thing up and saying, I feel horrible that I've been focused on this Wonder Woman script, which now isn't even going to get made because they want to go in a different direction, because I'm unable to get my stories out to my fans. That's really frustrating me, and I'm looking at different ways to do that. And he's clearly thinking about the internet. He was talking to J. Michael Straczynski, which was sort of the main guy behind Babylon 5.
Yep.
And talking to him about, you know, what are some direct DVD projects that can be done? What's some internet stuff that can be done? That's really, you know, I don't think he meant, you know, in place of the studios and the established distribution systems, but it's not that big a step to do those sorts of things without the established players.
Yeah.
And so I know that people, it's not a completely foreign thought. These things are being thought of by at least some established creative big names. And there's got to be a point where they're like, you know what? You guys, AMPTP, are being such douchebags about this.
Yeah.
We're just going to go over here, and you do what you want with your back catalog. That's fine. We're going to go over here, and we're fine.
Yeah.
And I don't know how likely that is or if that's, you know, something that's really being considered, but it is an option.
Yeah, but ultimately, these two sides, I believe, need each other, and they can talk all they want about creating some alternate source, but you know.
Well, I mean, you
one
look
controls
at,
the
right,
they, one controls the product, the product, and the other controls the delivery, and they just and I don't see that much different about that, despite what people try to think.
Well, the AMPTP does have the money, and they've got some new shows, but on the other hand, American Gladiators. Yeah. Celebrity Apprentice.
I know. But even those, I mean, it's really in the scheme of things, they're hugely successful, but hardly anymore. And American Gladiators will, I mean, it was the big series, made a big debut, but it will die. Look at the other big opening series this year, which was Bionic Woman. It's probably not even going to be renewed. So it's just because something delivers numbers initially doesn't mean it's going to.
Well, my point was that the stuff they're putting out is garbage.
Yeah. Yeah. It's terrible.
I mean, they are going to run out of new stuff sooner or later, and it's going to be all reality, all garbage. I think their hand gets a little less strong then.
Yeah.
Have you had a chance to see the Daily Shows or Colbert's?
Yeah.
Daily Shows and Colbert's?
Yeah, I made a point, kind of weird, but I chose not to watch them. Just because I just didn't want to see them flail. It's not that I'm like, oh, in support of the writers, but to a certain extent, I just didn't really want to see them flailing about or see something different. So I kind of chose, you know, I'm not going to watch him. The strike will be over and I'll watch it. I watched Letterman. I watched it when Howard Stern was on. But other than that, I kind of don't want to watch those shows until they get those writers back.
I totally respect that. But I watched.
Yeah,
or at least I watched two of the Daily Shows and I watched the first Colbert. I was really interested to see how they were going to treat the whole issue.
Yeah.
And they kind of... One of them had a, I think it was the Daily Show had a professor talking about labor relations and.
Yep. Oh God.
Go ahead.
PCFC Market Research. Oh great. Okay. Well, there I've answered that phone.
and sort of trying to address it, and it went. It wasn't horrible. It wasn't like a complete disaster.
Yeah.
It clearly wasn't as sharp. Colbert actually did a lot better than I would have thought in terms of him being a more scripted show and
really?
Having it be more of a, you know, he sort of.
That
you know,
was
he,
my
he
big
played,
question. That was what I was thinking is Colbert would be suffering more than.
Right, because he plays a character
yeah.
and it's, you know, it's more, it's just a different format than The Daily Show, which is, I think, a little more forgiving of not having writers, but. It wasn't that bad.
Yep.
It wasn't horrendously awkward. It still wasn't that. It wasn't as sharp. It wasn't as funny, but it was still in the ballpark. And Jon Stewart said, you know what? We're going to call it a Daily Show until we get our writers back.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, that's kind of a sign of solidarity. Stephen Colbert carrying on and saying, how come when I look at the thing, there's nothing in the teleprompter? Where are my words, Jimmy? The writers are on strike. What? No. This is the device that takes the words out of my head and puts them on the teleprompter so I can read them. so it was exactly what you'd expect. He's dealing with it from within the context of him being a jackass. So I don't know. Maybe if the quality declines, I'll stop. But I don't know. It's just sort of it's habit to watch The Daily Show.
Yeah. It is, but it has been habit for a while for me, so it was easy for me not to kind of do it for a while.
I totally know where you're coming from, yeah. but so we'll see how it goes and how it develops, and you know as they get in the rhythm, does that mean A, they're just getting better at what they're doing and surviving without the writers, or does it mean B, they run out of ideas rapidly? To me, it's because Stewart's got a background. You know, Stewart's been doing this for a long time, and he's actually been a stand-up comedian. So I think sort of those skills let him handle this, you know, give him the tools to handle it a little bit longer.
Yeah, Mar had the same thing in that he's a comedian, and his monologue was his. It actually felt almost the same, and the only difference is he did kind of man on the street interviews, which were very funny. I mean, Marr was really good, but you wonder how long that can last because It seemed pretty topical with Marn. I don't know with Jon Stewart, but that's got to be very scary and stressful for them to be writing their own stuff and trying to deliver. I mean, that can be challenging. But anyway.
Yeah. I don't know. It's, you know, it's an interesting dynamic. It's interesting to see it develop. You know, I still am firmly on the side of the writers. And I just...
Oh, I am too, but yeah.
And something else, we haven't talked about tech in a long time, and we've got Macworld on Tuesday.
I know, we've got the big... I've actually been reading all the rumor sites to see what the announcement would be. The stuff I've heard is this, and you can tell me if you heard something different, is the 2-pound sub-notebook, no optical drive Mac. The WiMAX enabled MacBook Pro.
I haven't heard that.
Well, that's what somebody is saying, that they might do that. Although that would be a heck of a commitment to a very poorly accepted so far new technology, which is a great technology, but nobody's really buying into it right now. But you know,
well, I gotta say, I'll be pretty torqued if they put that out and they don't somehow have some backward compatibility.
Well, you can get like a card for it, but the problem with WiMAX.
Well, you'd think, but when they went from airport to airport extreme, it was a totally different form factor, and you couldn't put a new card in an old
WiMAX
machine.
No, I mean like a PC card. I don't know how it works on a Mac.
I would hope, yeah, if.
But the problem with WiMAX
is PCMCIA slot.
Is WiMAX? It's sort of unrelated to the airport Wi-Fi thing. WiMAX is a.
Oh, totally.
Is a, you know, a broadband solution, and the problem there is just. It's expensive. I mean, I was looking at the Clearwire site last night. Clearwire is the big provider of it, run by Craig McCaw and stuff. And it's not cheap at all. Without the discount, it's like $100 a month to get broadband for one computer at your home and a laptop. And so what they're basically saying is you're spending $100 and the speed is two megabits per second, which is like a third of what I get with my broadband cable modem. So the only real benefit is you're getting real fast speeds from a wireless setup if you're driving through the city. But I don't know, it just seems vastly overpriced. It seems akin to the way cell phones used to be so overpriced.
Well, so what else aside from WiMAX?
And then the other thing that I had heard was that they're definitely going to make some renewed push. They have a new version of the Apple TV coming out that will, A, have some kind of LCD screen, but, B, mostly make it so it's not dependent on being connected to your computer. It's going to be its own terminal that you can sit down and order movies and order stuff straight from that terminal, and it's not having to be connected somehow to your computer somehow.
I did hear that it would maybe have a TV tuner built in.
I know my mom has been thinking about getting one because she got so ticked off at their cable company. They actually canceled it down there in Arizona, and she wants to so she's been waiting to kind of see what it's like, so she might get one of these things. But yeah, other than that, I haven't heard anything else out. I haven't heard much else. You know, they always talk about how after they work the kinks out of their new stuff, then they're going to have totally new cool form factors for their computers. And they're saying, well, they might do this here, but they'll be evolutionary rather than revolutionary designs. Like when they went from the iMac to the, what do they call that thing? The iBoob, the half basketball one to the later ones, and they're saying right now they don't anticipate that happening, but you never know with Steve Jobs. Either way, it's always exciting. Love watching that. I was thinking about doing a for our two readers, you know, you and me, doing a little live blogging of some of the different announcements. Just kind of take a post and add to it every once in a while, just to see what the thoughts were. I thought I might do that.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah, and it's interesting because I don't have any the sub notebook doesn't appeal to me at all because I don't travel. I wouldn't need it. I would not make use of that at all.
Yeah, I'm so not that kind of person. To me, I don't care. I want a 17-inch screen. I want it wide. I don't care. I want a full replication of my desktop experience. I do not need nor want anything small ever. There's no reason ever I would need something like that, except for maybe watching a movie in an airplane, and this doesn't have a DVD player, so scratch that.
Well, I could totally see, you know, I can see the need for it. It's just not me. Okay. Maybe they announce iPhone 2. Well, you know, it's interesting how they're going to handle the iPhone changes, because apparently, you know, there's the FCC review, or FEC.
Yep.
Wait. I'm blanking now. I'm really tired. There's a review from the agency that has to approve it. That's like a publicly, you know, it's like a public FCC. 6-month or 4-month review process. That it's out there what you want to do. So it'll be interesting how they handle that without everyone saying, well, why would I buy an iPhone now when in 4 months I get this?
Yeah.
Because traditionally they don't, you know, there's the rumor site saying, well, if I was interested in a sub notebook, clearly I should wait till after Tuesday. I don't want to go into the Apple store today and buy one because I'll just be pissed in 3 days.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a little bit of that, and you can either be an informed consumer and know not to buy something before Macworld, but that's a little different than like a 4 or 6 month period where, you know, you've got people who know that there's something better coming along.
Yeah, I know.
That's going to be a really hard business case.
You know, it's funny you bring up the iPhone. There's a blog I read very irregularly by some guy. I can't remember his first name. Last name is Knox, and I think he works for Microsoft, and it definitely is a guy who's drinking the Kool-Aid. That said, there's a lot of valuable stuff on there, but boy, you cannot do wrong. It's kind of the opposite of Major Nelson, who seems pretty free to talk about what he wants to talk about. So he mentioned some new software that is for Windows Mobile 5 and 6, and soon to be for backwards compatible with the Pocket PC 2003 software, which I have on my little Pocket PC. And effectively, it's basically a new user interface, so you can run your programs using this new interface, and it's exactly like the iTouch. In other words, it's all big stuff you can see, and you're dragging your finger across to move to the next thing and everything else. They basically, the iPhone, they basically replicated that, and I'm thinking, damn. So Microsoft has had this technology to be able to do that for 10 years, and now, after 10 years, it's taken some third-party open-source person to essentially take advantage of what Apple did in the space of 6 months to develop. It's clearly better. You know, it's kind of interesting how they're doing that. What's cool is the Microsoft architecture is so open. So the hard part about this is when this happens is it's so hard editing the things together.
Oh, well, see, God. I'm just happy pretending that it wasn't happening.
I know, but it's not a matter of that. It's the editing is so hard because you got to
leave
line
it in.
Up.
Whatever. It's two idiots talking.
I know. No. I'm telling you, every cut is 15 minutes of lining it up. Not editing stuff out. I'm not even bothering to edit it. I'm just saying, just the lining it up. It's like, oh, every time it breaks down, I've gone, oh, there's 15 more minutes of my life. Ugh. But anyway. So what else? What else is on our list?
I can't believe we forgot about this. Blu-ray HD DVD.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, looks like the war is over.
It really, it's really fascinating to watch. So what happened 2 weeks ago, Warner's, which previously had been releasing things in both formats, announced that in the middle of the year they will be Blu-ray only.
Yeah.
And everybody essentially said, well, that's it. Format war is over, because that leaves Paramount and Universal and, you know, a few of the smallers like New Line and Lionsgate as the only HD DVD people. And within the space of a couple of days, like, New Line and Lionsgate said, okay, Blu-ray for us. And apparently Paramount and or Universal are already looking at switching and saying, you know, if our contracts allow us to switch if this happens or if that happens. And so suddenly you've got Toshiba sort of left, you know, stood up at the prom, you know, trying to pretend they're still viable with their format.
Yeah.
And you talk about a losing battle. It's that I to some degree, I feel bad for Toshiba trying to spin this. And there's no way to spin it because you have lost.
Yep.
You cannot recover from this. It's done.
Yeah.
If nobody will put stuff out on your format, it doesn't matter if it's better. It doesn't matter if your next generation is awesome. It doesn't matter if it's cheaper to manufacture the discs.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. And of course, you know, I put a post up about, you know, does this mean Microsoft makes a Blu-ray add-on drive like they did an HD DVD add-on drive?
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of there was a, like last week or earlier this week, you know, one of the marketing, one of the Xbox group guys, you know, publicly said, well, you know, we'll do whatever the public support is for. You there?
Yep.
Okay. You know, we'll do the whatever the public wants. And I thought, you know what, dude, that is not, I, you know, I'm sure that Microsoft has agreements with Toshiba that they have agreed to support HD DVD and they don't want to leave Toshiba sort of completely out in the wind because, you know, clearly there's a relationship there because the first Zunes were basically Toshiba gigabits.
Yeah.
You know, the internals were mostly Toshiba, so clearly they don't want to piss all over their partner. On the other hand, you know, Microsoft is sort of, you know, they need to at least announce that, yes, they will do this.
Yeah.
And what they should have done is had a Skunkworks project going where they had already done it. You know, maybe they didn't tell Toshiba, maybe their contract prevents them from either A, doing it, or B, telling anyone about it, but they should have been doing it. They shouldn't have allowed themselves to get in that position, and I'm just speculating, I have no idea. But to me, it's the same situation as, you know, when Steve Jobs gets up there and says, we've had a team writing writing OS X for Intel for a while now, or, you know, for these chips, because we needed a plan B, and... You know, it's not quite that business critical for Microsoft or Xbox, but to me, it's like, you know what? Okay, this format's not working. Great. Here's this format. There is no what, because the problem is you don't want people buying a PlayStation 3 based on the fact that it's a Blu-ray player. You know, people have been holding out and saying, you know, I'm not quite sure who's going to win the format war. I'm not really ready to commit.
Well,
maybe
plus
this is enough
plus
to push
them
over the edge.
Did you see a bunch of the news this past week about how, so they have all these new standards that are going to be in the next version of Blu-ray? Of course, a lot of this stuff was in HD, this whole thing of having two video streams going on at the same time and stuff like that. So they're talking all this stuff, and then they're saying, okay, and by the way, all you people that have those first generation 8 or D Blu-ray players, the new Blu-ray discs, they're not going to work with your stuff.
Yes, I did hear that.
And I'm thinking that's funny that, of course, when they finally announce that Blu-ray is going to win, the first announcement of people that have committed to the Blu-ray format is, oh, by the way, and this is how you're going to be screwed. You know, it's kind of funny.
Well, yeah, so to me, I mean, Microsoft really should have had this ready to go, and if they're not going to sell it, then say...
How many times has Microsoft ever done something like that, though?
Well, it's astounding. It's not. Why wouldn't they? They've
I
got
agree.
The money, they've got a ton of smart people, they've got resources. Why would they not say...
Because Microsoft rarely bets on things that they're not following through on. In other words, to a certain extent... Apple was doing what they're doing, but there's a possibility. There's been some big things that secretly, apparently, Apple's sunk a lot of money and then said, you know what, we're not going to do that. Let's cancel that project. You never hear about it. And Microsoft rarely does it. When they do it, they do it and they put it out, and at no point do they somehow cancel it before anybody hears about it, because they later go, you know, this is just not working. Let's not do it. They sort of, once they start putting money into it, it's going to come out no matter how bad it is.
Well, I see where you're coming from, but to me, it's just there's such a great business case for having already had, or at least announcing that, yes, we will support this. Not some, well, we'll see equivocation, because all that's going to do is make people who are on the fence, you know, think, screw it, I'll get a PS3 now.
Yeah.
You know, if, because I, you know, it's, maybe I'm overstating it, but I, you know, I think there's a fair amount of people that, you know, we're kind of holding off. And if this is the reason, if this pushed them over the edge to the PS3, that's Microsoft making a huge blunder, because you don't want to give anyone any excuse to get a rival product. And right now, that is a reason to get the rival product.
I agree.
You know, and even if, you know, and I totally agree with their reasoning for not having it be included in the box itself, because you're forcing a cost on people that wouldn't want it necessarily.
Yeah.
So I think adding the external drive, even though it's, you know, it's not as attractive, you have to deal with another thing, I agree that by doing that, you're not making people who just want to play games on it pay for the movie stuff that they will never use.
Yeah.
I totally agree with that. And I think Sony, by pricing it so high, because they did that, you know, I understand why they did it, but it clearly, you know, all those surveys that show all these PS3 owners had no idea that these machines could play Blu-ray.
Yeah.
You almost have to wonder if those surveys are valid, because how could anyone
be that
stupid?
How can you be that dumb? Did you see the other big Sony news, though? Speaking of shoes dropping, Sony finally said, yep, we're going to sell all of our entire catalog of songs and music through Amazon DRM-free. Now every single major manufacturer is selling their work. It was coming on the heels of Sony. Some guy did the funniest post where he explained what it would be like how Sony was trying to do it before they finally did this announcement to buy their product. You had to go to a store, buy a gift card. It'd be like to get a pizza. You want to order pizza at your house. You'd have to drive 20 miles to some store to buy a card for the right to buy pizza, then go home. I mean, it was crazy. So, but anyway, they've decided, no, we're going through Amazon and we're going to sell it DRM free. And it's funny, a couple, like the last week, I had the occasion where I had to buy a couple pieces of music. I wanted to buy them and I went to Amazon, and now I have this DRM-free thing, and I will never share it. I don't have any interest in sharing it. I want it. I paid for it. And it's like, I don't know how the things are going to play out, but that's what I've always wanted. I've wanted the right to buy it without having some weird restrictions, and I have no interest in sharing it, and it's finally happening. And I wonder how it will play out, you know?
I agree.
Do you see Radiohead's thing, even though they basically gave their thing away for free when they finally sold it, it debuted at number one?
No, I missed that.
It's number one album in the country. That said, I don't know how much it's selling, but number one album in the country.
I'm
looking at the box office charts, and there's a couple of things that are kind of, I don't know. What would you guess the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford had done? What would you figure how much that would that made in the theaters?
Oh, I don't know, $10 million.
$3.8 million.
Oh.
Isn't that painful?
Considering
they sat on it for so long because they were worried about it, and to a certain extent, and it got really good reviews, and it just didn't pay off. I mean, it just did nothing. And then another one that just did terrible was Sleuth, that big remake that had...
Oh, yeah.
That
looked interesting. I wouldn't have minded seeing that, but not in the theater.
Yeah, well, Sleuth made... $300,000.
Wow.
Yeah, that's just unbelievable. So, anyway.
Well, I think we should probably wrap up.
Yep. And then I will begin the laborious process of editing the whole thing together.
So you guys rock at mustardayonnaise.com. That's how you contact us.
Yep.
You can, of course, go to the website, which Richard has been toiling over to great effect.
Yeah,
Richard has now clearly surpassed whatever HTML abilities I have long since forgotten.
No, there's no HTML. It's all PHP. Actually, a little HTML.
PHP
mostly PHP.
Lays on an HTML base, known for error.
That's true. That's true.
So you could visit the website where Richard and I poke at each other about GamerScore.
I laughed so hard when I saw your first post, and then your second post was equally funny. I said it to my mom. She thought it was funny, too.
My elite gamer scores are not colon-focused enough.
I don't know. They were both very, very funny.
Anyway, I am Matt.
I am Richard.
And thank you for listening.
Okay.
See you next time.